Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Liz from Lather Up Litany, and I want to just say to everyone, welcome. A lot of you are going to be listening to this show after it's gone live. The reason being, we apologize. We always want to have live shows, and we like to advertise, but we have had a lot of technical issues, you know, without getting into too much detail with Blog Talk Radio. You know, we've reached out, you know, we're trying to resolve them, but they're kind of out of our control. You know, so we just wanted to let you know why. We're just being a little cautious. And we're really, really excited for this show. We have our good friend Michael Caruso, the writer and creator of Winter Thorn, which has taken the web by storm, joining us tonight to discuss this project. Very quickly, Brittany, do you want to say hello?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We're really excited to have Michael on, and really looking forward to picking his brain about his newest endeavor.
Absolutely. You know, we will get started now. I'm not sure if Michael's going to announce right now or after the show. If he announces when we're live, guys, we're not doing the chat again because we're just being very, very cautious. We are currently looking into a new platform so we can be chatting with you all again. But very quickly, you know, if he decides to announce, just keep in mind we will be checking our Twitter, which is Litany. And, you know, you can definitely find us, you know, if you obviously follow us on Twitter. I know a lot of you do. And we'll be looking to see what fans are tweeting. But Britt, Michael's in the queue, and I just want to do a quick intro, and then I will bring Mr. Caruso right on.
Sounds great.
All right. Tonight we welcome Michael Caruso back to Litany. Michael is the writer and creator of the online web series Divanity, that took the web by storm in 2011 and earned Michael and his crew a well-deserved Daytime Emmy nomination. Centered around a dysfunctional family, Divanity captured many of the elements that fans look for in their soap opera, including greed, family secrets, betrayal, and redemption. Many were sad when Divanity came to an end, but Michael quickly let fans know that he had another project in the works. This project was later revealed to be Winter Thorn, a four-part web event that debuted on August 27, 2015. This saga includes an all-star cast of daytime favorites and again has drawn attention for its impeccable attention to detail and incredible storytelling. Again, centered around a feuding and dysfunctional family, Winter Thorn is unique in that it takes place in a futuristic world and, by Michael's own admission, whimsical setting. Winter Thorn is unique in that women hold all the power, while men tend to take on subservient roles. There is also a long history of hostility and violence that begins to slowly unfold in part one. Join us as we welcome Michael back to Litany to chat Winter Thorn and more. So also I want to say very quickly, guys, you know, we have not watched the finale yet. We were originally scheduled to do this Monday. So a lot of our questions we wanted to keep general. Also, Michael likes to give people a chance to watch the show. And part four, the finale, actually just debuted today. But we are really excited to have him on. He's in the queue, and I'm going to bring him on right now. Michael, are you
there?
Hi,
girl. I'm here. How are you?
Hey,
hi.
Michael.
Hi, girls. You know, you always have the most thoughtful introductions. I'm always, like, listening, and I'm like, okay, yeah, that's kind of cool.
Well, you know, we tell it how it is. We really, you know, we are very, very excited to have you on, Michael. And, again, we want
to
thank you.
I'm thrilled to be here. You always have the best questions, so I'm really excited about this.
Yes.
No pressure.
Yes. Britt and I, like, we actually will text prior to interviews and, like, be like, we're so excited. And, like, all week we've been like, we're so excited. Because, honestly, you know, you make it easy, Michael, because you give us a lot to, you know, a lot of things to think about. And we really enjoyed putting these questions together. And we really can't wait to talk Winter Thorn with you.
Thank you.
So,
and
you know,
I did tweet it out on Winterthorne and on my account. So I don't know how many people have noticed that or whatnot. But
okay.
And anybody can tweet me any questions. I would prefer it, you know, I always feel like an ogre. I don't want people to think that I'm, you know, flapping hands. I don't want people to enjoy the show. But I think it's, you got to, because it's an online series, you have to get used to the fact that not everybody watches it at the same time. So I just don't want it ruined for anybody. And then after a week or so, you know, have at it or whatnot. But I just want people to be able to enjoy it spoiler-free. But that being said, if you have any behind-the-scenes questions or tech questions,
yep,
or, you know, I'm confused about the characters or whatnot, please feel free to ask. I'm happy to answer anything within reason.
Good deal.
Absolutely. And, you know, we respect that. We like, you know, we're going to watch it probably right after Litany. So you'll find a lot of these questions, Michael, they're meant to be, you know, kind of give you free rein, be broad, not give too much away. You know,
sure.
So, you know, to discuss what you're comfortable with, but we're going to jump right into it. And I know
all
I
right.
joke around and always say, get ready for, you know, a really jam-packed hour, but Brittany can vouch. We have a lot for you, Michael. So the first thing we wanted to ask was when you first came on Litany, you had talked about how you always had been drawn to stories that centered around dysfunctional families. And not only dysfunctional families, but those that really had to put on a facade for the outside public. You had mentioned how living in downtown LA next to the jewelry district gave you the idea for Divanity to be centered on a crumbling jewelry empire. Obviously, Winterthorne centers around the candy business, and
right.
we wanted to know what inspired that theme of candy.
You know, I've said this before in interviews. My grandmother and I were very, very close, and she was a huge fan of the big primetime soaps of the 80s. And I always wanted to grow up to kind of create the types of shows that she would have enjoyed watching, or anybody
mm-hmm.
else in my
yeah.
family that they would have enjoyed watching. And she loved candy. She was a big, she was a tiny little woman, but she could eat her weight in candy. And she and I used to sit, they had a finished garage up in Buffalo, New York. And we used to sit in the garage and eat spearmint leaves and gumdrops and those cinnamon bears and just eat those for hours and talk and hang out and all that stuff when I was a kid. So I love the idea of taking something innocent like candy and really giving it a dark undercurrent. And I love the idea, you know, I think it's like I said back when we talked about Divanity. To me, a great soap is when you've got something worth fighting over. What are the secrets? What are the things that all families, and I think that's why people relate to soap operas, because family mm-hmm. problems are universal. All families ideally don't like to air their dirty laundry to the public. They all
mm-hmm.
have facades. Anybody on earth can relate to that, maybe not to the extreme like a Winterthorne or a Divanity, but everybody, you know, everybody's got that member of the family that they really would like to kind of keep tucked away. So I think that's a universal thing that when you kind of combine it with an element that people love candy and people get excited about candy, and it's kind of interesting to interweave those two concepts together to create what we've done.
Absolutely awesome.
One thing I absolutely love too is this is the way that you each time now so far, you know, we've seen with Divanity and now we've seen with Winterthorne, but you seem to you nail it. Like where no, like a lot of the web series kind of, you know, center around the same types of issues or the same types of settings or what have you. Each time it's like completely different, and I love, and each time, you know, I'd said it earlier, like you deliver every time, and
you're very sweet. Thank you.
I
definitely set out with Winterthorne to, and you know, listen, I admire and respect and appreciate all of the other web soaps. I think that they all have something unique to bring to the table. What I really
sure.
wanted to do was something absolutely 360 different from anything else that was out there and anything that I had ever personally done. What I didn't want to do was recreate Divanity only with candy. I very much wanted it to be a fantasy that takes place in an alternate, not a futuristic setting, but an alternate world where
okay.
it is, it's modern time, but it's
mm-hmm.
a different type of modernism. And it's a different, there's a different I guess, law of the land, and there's just a different set of rules. And it's really been fascinating following all of the discussions on Twitter and the message board. Some people are loving that. Some people are like, this is too weird for me. I don't get it. I don't like this. And that's totally understandable. It's not designed to be comfortable, and it's not designed to be something that's familiar. It's designed to turn things on end. One of the most fascinating things to me about this whole experience, what I really set out to do was create a world where women were absolutely, completely in charge. And what I've noticed is that the audience loves having women in charge, and they love strong females, and they love these powerful women. What's fascinating is that I don't know if they're as comfortable with the concept of the men being the nurturers. I think that that's something that some viewers have really struggled with, you know, maybe perceiving, you know, Victor specifically or even Max as being, you know, weaker or whatnot. And, you know, and that's kind of the self stereotype that I really wanted to go against, where you look at men a little bit differently. It doesn't make them weak. It doesn't make them wimps. It doesn't make them anything like that. It means that they exist to support the women in their lives. And I think that sometimes you really have to suspend your disbelief and pull out of it enough to say, if I wouldn't accuse a woman of being weak for supporting a man, why would I accuse a man of being weak for supporting a woman? And that's a lot for some people to wrap their minds around. And that's been really interesting to see how the audience really feels about that change in dynamic.
And touched on something. Oh, Britt, I'm sorry. I just wanted to really, really quickly say, because I jotted it down. You said that they're not meant, or you said, you know, some people view, like, Victor as weak. I have to be honest, I absolutely, it is very strange, no doubt, and that's what I love about Winterthorn, that, you know, you're doing this, and it's something different. But I don't view him as weak. What I would say to people, and what I love, is that he's loyal. It's a different type of, you know, he's strong in the fact that he's so loyal. I mean, without giving too much away, if you've never watched the series, I just want to say, you know, when he talked about why he wears those gloves and what he was willing to do to protect his woman, I thought that was amazing. I really like that.
It's also, I can't remember who I was talking to the other day, but we were having a discussion about the roles that men and women play in soap operas. And you'll notice that daytime dramas specifically are the only genre on planet Earth where men are typically objectified the way women are in all other forms of media. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you've got guys baking cookies wearing nothing but an apron, or answering the front door in nothing but a towel. And I think that the average soap viewer has really been, I don't want to say trained because that's a disrespectful word, but they've been encouraged to view men in a very specific way. And, you know, it would be the same concept as me saying, why would I have my female characters running around in bikinis the entire time? It's not supposed to make sense in the aspect of, this is something normal that you would see in the everyday world. This is not the everyday world. And I'm really proud of that, because it's challenging the audience to do something different. You know, when we started with this, I said to Martha, you know, I said, I'm a little worried. This might be too high concept. This might be too much mythology and too much asking people to really suspend their disbelief. And ultimately, Martha said, you know, don't underestimate the intellect of the soap viewer. And I agreed with that. I was like, you know what, fuck it. I'm just going to go there. And if some people hate it, which they do, they're going to hate it. And there's nothing that I can do to change that. But the people that do like it and do appreciate it, I think, are really bonded to the series. And people have really, I would say overall, have just been incredibly supportive and amazing and really just really excited by this concept.
I agree. Yep, I think the change is what I, as a viewer and a fan of the show, the difference, the change, like, I welcomed it because, like you said, I mean, we're, you know, for us that are, you know, loyal daytime fans and have been for years, we're used to the same types of roles, the same types of storylines. And so this, as a kind of, you know, a reversal in a way, like, That's what I loved most about it. And I felt like it was a perfect blend, too. Like, it wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like you overdid it in terms of having the men being more submissive or what have you. That's what I've appreciated most about this.
Well, I mean, you know, in television for years, you see these larger-than-life male characters, and they're surrounded by the women of their family, and they're all looking at each other and putting up with a lot of bullshit or trying to look the other way or trying to be supportive. And you don't, I'll say it again, you don't look at women as being weak for being behind the scenes running their family and trying to be the peacekeepers. Why necessarily would you accuse a man of being weak for doing the exact same thing? It's just that you just don't see it at all in typical television or web soaps or whatever you want to call it. So I literally think it just you have to just be willing to say this is their world and it works in that world. Mm-hmm. It's just something a little bit off the beaten path.
Yeah. We want to kind of ask you, kind of moving into your writing process.
Okay.
As a writer, do you have a particular format when you sit down or when you sat down to write this story? Did you start from the beginning and work from beginning to end, or did you pick particular scenes or dialogue and work from that?
With Divanity, that's typically how I did it. I had scenarios, and then I would build the script around it. Winterthorn is different because, you know, writing Winterthorn was a real challenge for me in the aspect that I had gotten spoiled with Divanity over the years. You know, we had Divanity for 4 seasons, and, you know, once you've got your characters established, sky's the limit, and you can take them in a million different directions, and you can do a million different things. It's very tricky when you're building a show in the first season. You want it to be interesting, but especially in the case of Winterthorn, there is a ton of history and a ton of mythology and a ton of setup. And how do you make that setup compelling? That's why I decided to go the current storyline with the flashbacks running parallel so that we could really get everybody caught up to speed over these 4 episodes. Unlike Divanity, which was much more traditional in that it was much more cliffhanger-esque or whatnot, Winterthorn is really, you have to watch all 4 episodes for it to make sense. A lot of people are like, oh, I watched the first episode and it's confusing. I don't want to watch anymore. Of course it's confusing. It's the first episode of a show. We're just building this landscape. So, you know, when I was writing it, I knew who my major characters were. I knew what I ultimately wanted to have happen. But it was really just about weaving it together. So I did begin with the first episode and go all the way to the 4th episode. I literally had post-it notes. I was sitting at my dining room table, and my dining room windows were covered, and I'm not kidding, covered with post-it notes with potential this person here, this person there, you know, moving around everything. So it was really like a big puzzle to tell the story in the most clear way possible while making it interesting enough to want, you know, to leave it where people are wanting more.
It was, you know, we kind of wanted to actually tie into it as well. Like, I'm glad that you brought up how, you know, the Divanity too, because a lot of these we have compared, you know, or questioned how they differ. And we know that in the past you had to work around actor schedules to get the shooting done. What was the shooting schedule like, and how did it differ from Divanity this time versus last?
Shooting schedule is, without a doubt, hands down, my least favorite part of any of this. I despise it. You know, when you're writing something and you know you're an indie production, right? So if I know that I have X amount of dollars, I don't have $100,000. I don't have $200,000. So if I, you know, the first question I have to ask myself is, what are my resources? What do I have available to me that I can pull this off? The second question that I have to ask myself is, do I have more high quality episodes? I mean, not low quality, but basically, do I have fewer episodes with a higher production value, or do I have 8 episodes with a moderate production value based on the money that I have to work with? So very early on, I made the decision this is going to be a 4-part, almost miniseries kind of show, rather than, you know, there were far more Divanity episodes, but it wasn't, Divanity wasn't as hyper-stylized, so the expense was a lot different. The other big difference is that, you know, I didn't pay everybody on Divanity. Most people were able to volunteer their time, and everybody got paid on Winterthorn, which was something, after 4 years of so many people volunteering, I was like, you know, everybody needs to get paid. Every crew member, every actor, everybody. And, you know, the only two people that did not get paid were myself and my wife. We didn't take a dime for doing this. Because we really wanted to make sure that everybody was excited and committed and, you know, getting a little something for their work. That being said, people will say, well, why isn't Kathleen in it more? Or why isn't Linda in it more? You know, no disrespect to any actor on earth that is not a celebrity. I include myself being the non-celebrity factor. These are working actors that have insane schedules and are constantly working. And, you know, there's a price point issue. There's an availability issue. It's very tricky because you don't want to build somebody in so much that, God forbid, there's a schedule crisis or something happens at the last minute that you're effectively screwed in the middle of a shoot. So, you know, I pretty much stuck with what I did. I built the series regulars around people that I knew that I could get. You know, everybody, thankfully, on Twitter has been like, we want season two. You know, Martha was not on Days of Our Lives when we filmed this. She hadn't gotten back on the show yet, so she was available. Mm-hmm. We filmed it over a three-week period.
Mm-hmm.
She had, you know, she had much more availability moving forward into season two. That is a great cause of concern for me because, you know, I know that we'll try our best if she's wanting to return, which by all conversations she is. You know, the scheduling thing, it's an issue, and you really do have to write around people's schedules. It's, you know, I don't write myself as the second lead because I'm a narcissist. I'm free, and I'm available. So it's
and you do a good job, I would argue.
I appreciate that.
Please, don't sell yourself short.
It boils down to function after a while, and, you know, how much am I able to get access to these people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately, as any show becomes more successful, people make themselves more available to you. You know, a lot of the stars that we had on the first season of Winterthorn, they were so excited to do it, and they really accommodated us, and everybody was wonderful. But these are some busy people, I will say that. They're very, very, very busy.
Really quick, I wanted to point out what you just touch on what you said about Liz, anyway, saying about you in this, I really, really enjoyed watching, I mean, you from Jason to Vanity to Victor
God,
Winter,
yes.
Night and day. Like, I loved it.
Yes. Yes.
It's hard
I
to not
the
be
thing.
The snarky one whipping out the one-liners. He's been a very big change. Like, for me as an actor, after playing Jason for 4 years, it's very different. And especially since Victor, I would say, is the character on the show that's received the most criticism and is understood the least. For me as an actor and as a writer, you can't help but second guess yourself and say, well, did I go too far? Am I not conveying this? Is this, you know, I'm always examining everything that I do, not just me personally, but when I create the show, no matter how many accolades you get, you know, I always want to be better and I always want to improve, and I'm always looking for ways to say, okay, I need to tweak that, I need to fix that. But, you know, it's part of the learning curve.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally thought that, you know, I mean, obviously you're the person in the role, but I think that you, for me, made me kind of, you brought me inside his head, you know what I mean? I kind of, it is a very different role, especially from Jason. And, you know, just in general, like you said, from what we're used to seeing and, you know, how soaps often betray men. And I felt like, especially, I think it all came together for me in part three in terms of, like, feeling like I really got to know Victor. So I think, you know, you did an amazing job. Yeah, yeah, that was
It's interesting, you know, somebody on Twitter, I don't even remember the handle, they were saying that, you know, Victor and Miranda have no sexual chemistry with each other. And I thought that was interesting because if you look at your grandparents, for example, you don't picture them boinking each other. You know what I mean? They're a married couple.
Right.
Yes.
And it's kind of the same thing where as we set up Winterthorn, it's really about what goes on in a marriage beneath the surface. And I think that, you know, having people rip each other's clothes off and fuck up against a wall, while very entertaining, doesn't necessarily drive the story forward. And mm-hmm. I think it's important that in a marriage, yes, of course, sex is a very important element. You know, you've also got Victor and Miranda is, you know, this is a different world where, you know, men aren't overtly sexual in this world. They're not, you know, mm-hmm, time for us to sleep together. They don't do that. And Victor started off as a servant. And I think that he's psychologically programmed to kind of know his place, even though he is the husband, and he gets pissed sometimes, but there is a structuring within the family that men don't just say, all right, Miranda, I'm horny now. It doesn't work like that in this family. So you really, once again, it's asking the audience to fully immerse themselves in the rules of this world to understand the type of man that Victor or Max, or I mean, Colin probably not so much because he left before he could get completely mm-hmm. trained, but that's kind of it's just a goofy, weird, different world.
That ties into the next question, actually. I'm sorry, what were you going to say, Britt?
I was just going to say, I like how it's like sexuality and is not in the forefront. Like the story itself carries, you know, the writing itself carries. They don't have to rely on that anyway. So I thought that was, you know, I noticed that from the beginning too. I'm like, you know, I think this is going to be one of those, you know, the story is going to carry. We're not going to have to worry about them banging every episode or something. You know what I mean?
Well, and you know what, and listen,
there's too much happening.
There's a place for that. But, you know,
right.
In four episodes, when you're trying to construct a literal world from the ground up, you know, you have to pick and choose. And, you know, moving mm-hmm. forward, there is room for the exploration and looking more at, you know, if we do move forward, which I'm hoping and anticipating that we will, there's going to be more room for exploring that dynamic between all of the characters. And, you know, you have to prioritize. And I figured there's so much of that in daytime as it is. Once again, I didn't want to do what everybody else is doing. I really didn't want to do that. It doesn't interest me. And you know, I when you have 5 days a week over months and months and a year to have that in your story, God bless you. Go for it. Do it. But if you've got four episodes, there's going to be a different structure priority from my point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Michael, you kind of just touched on it a little, but you said how, you know, this is a much different, you know, world, obviously, than you know, not just the Vanny, but what we're used to seeing in soaps and on the web. You know, so while Winterthorn and the Vanny both center, obviously, around, you know, families and, you know, their secrets, obviously Winterthorn is very unique in that it takes place in a whimsical setting. And I'm sorry, I know mm-hmm. whimsical is kind of a cheesy word, but you know what I mean. It's a very different world.
It's a great word. It's a great word.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I was like, I don't think I'm cheesy. But when it came time for production, Michael, how did you go about capturing this vision of how you wanted this world to look like? Were there particular areas you focused on? The reason we're asking is because, again, you nailed it. If you were to say to me, you know, what is this world like? I'd say, you know, you have to watch it. I can't really put it into worlds. I get that it's meant to be different, not just, you know, because people have different roles. There's a scenery aspect as well. And you know, in terms of wardrobe, in terms of hair, in terms of obviously, you know, the setting, even in the house when they have that, you know, candy dinner. How did you go about, you know, you said there's a limited budget, but you pulled it off. How did you go about making sure that you were able to reflect, you know, this vision?
I think that for me, it was really important to integrate the candy into the show from almost an organic perspective. You know, these women in the family, they were born out of the forest, right? They came from this forest area. and, you know, people always talk about the feathers and whatnot. I wanted to merge candy, which is highly fake and highly processed, with organic elements that come from nature. That's why we see a lot of the feathers and a lot of the textures, and you see it's candy, but it's made into a tree, or the candy is shaped like a frog or a bug or something like that. You know, there's always elements of nature in everything that exists in this faction of the Winterthorn world. So this specific family is more forest-oriented. Other factions of the family will have a different theme should we move forward. The ocean and the desert being, you know, what I'm kind of, you know, leaning towards right now. So I really wanted to come up with creative ways of using the candy to make it part of their world, make it part of the decoration, make it part of the house, but just enough, not building a literal house out of candy, but incorporating it in the design and the decorative elements to really just this is just part of their world. It's perfectly natural where they come from because they've been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's not even a second thought to them. And I'd like to think that this is a family that before things became so corrupted, there's a real joy in their work. You know, men basically, like a rooster puffs out his feathers, how a man gets a Winterthorn woman to show, you know, to get interested is they put on these big candy displays. And, you know, Victor makes a field of lollipops, or there's a field of candy canes or whatever. That's how the men show that they love their wives. They create these things. They're artists. And, you know, as a Winterthorn woman, you win when you have a husband that is the best candy maker. So it's almost, instead of literal sex, it's sex with your eyes. It's kind of like this, you know, these guys might not look like Abercrombie and Fitch models, but their beauty is exhibited by their gifts and their talents and their ability to create something out of nothing. And that's very sexy to a Winterthorn woman. So it's all part of the set design. I wanted people to feel immersed in this world, and I wanted to, all of the candy was real. We didn't use any fake candy whatsoever. Every lollipop, every marshmallow, every gumdrop that you see, that is all real candy. And it's also, it's good for the actors. You know, in a world of green screen and digital and fake, I really wanted to put the actors in a world where this was real for them too. And I think that you can tell that the performances are completely different because the actors come to set and they're like, oh my God, this is so cool. And they get into it and they get excited by it. And once you've got that excitement generated within an actor, you got them, you know, they're ready to give you 100%.
I think that's
Michael,
smart.
Very quickly, before, you know, it kind of ties in with the next question as well. But I want to just say very quickly, too, because you mentioned one of my favorite scenes personally. When Victor makes that display, for Miranda, just to give you an idea of, like, how I interpreted it, you said, and Martha said, don't underestimate the fan, because for me, that was one of my favorite scenes, because I looked at it, and I felt you guys had great chemistry, because to be honest, that was for me the scene where Miranda knew Victor was the one.
Absolutely.
And to be able to pull it off in, like, literally just a few minutes, you know, during part one, when we don't have, you know, a lot of background yet because of the way the sequences work, was pretty awesome. And I really enjoyed that scene.
Thank you very much.
So I just had to say that. I'm sorry. And, Michael, it does tie in. It's like you read our minds because we're always like, yeah, this is what we were going to ask. I'm like, damn, he's good. Michael, when we had the lovely Martha Madison on, she was awesome, great interview. We had her on a few weeks ago. She told us a little bit about how you guys initially connected with her at the Daytime Emmys. That's where you guys met, and you later had reached out to her about possibly playing Miranda. You know, we know you are a big advocate of daytime, and we were just curious, were you familiar with Martha's previous work, on Days or The Bay, and what made you reach out to her in particular about playing this role?
I had never seen her on Days. I'd never seen her on Days when all of this went down. I'd seen her a little bit on The Bay, and I'd seen her a little bit on Soapbox. But when I met her at the Emmys, there was just something. Sometimes you meet people and something just kind of strikes a chord with you. And after I'd met her, I did a little bit more research on her after the fact, and, you know, reading comments and message boards and kind of delving more into her career history. And what fascinated me is that there was a, you know, a reasonable amount of people that sold Martha really short. And, you know, it's, you know, I've never been on a daytime soap, so I can't even imagine what that's like to begin with. But then to be a recast of a very beloved actor is a really difficult job. And, you know, as I watched some clips of her as she was on Days originally, and what I noticed, it wasn't even her performance, it was the writing, that they wrote her as a very soft, meek, not weak, but meek character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, reading comments and what people had to say, I was fascinated by the idea of, I love giving actors a chance to play something that they don't typically play. And I love the idea of saying, okay, you might think that this person is only capable of this, but I think that we can get around that. And I think that we can prove that there's more to this person. And that's what I met at the Emmys. What I met was somebody who's very strong and very opinionated and just, you know, yearning to prove themselves. And Martha had not been on Days for, it had been 7 years. And out of respect for Gregory and The Bay, you know, she had sent me a friend request shortly after the Emmys. And I said to her, are you still on The Bay? The only thing that would have prevented Martha from being in Winterthorne if she was still on The Bay, because I don't believe in poaching other actors, not lead actors,
yeah.
I should say. You know, it's one thing to guest star or whatever, but I would never do that to them. And she had said that she had recently left The Bay, so she was open to something new and different, and that's when we took the meeting, and I kind of pitched her. But Martha was literally the only person that was ever considered for this part. There was never anybody else even remotely in the running for it. So had she said no, we would have figured something out. But I was pretty confident that when we, you know, kind of explained what we were trying to do, that she would take to it. And she did. And God love her. She, you know, as an actress, she really committed to the part. There wasn't anything she wasn't willing to do. She really jumped in. And I'm just, we were so thrilled to have her.
Yeah, no, you know, it was, I was going to just say really quickly, too, one of the first things that I actually said to Britt, I believe after part one, was I texted Britt and I said, it is so, you know, Martha had hinted this and she talked about how this was, you know, really multidimensional character that really is going to change, you know, really change right before the viewer's eyes in a matter of just four episodes. And I could tell she was really excited about it. And I actually even discussed this with my mother. She knows, you know, she's a huge, you know, fan of your work too. And we were all discussing how this is a role that we would not have had the opportunity to see Martha in. I mean, Belle Black, we love her. We loved her as the recast, but a much different character. Doesn't even
close.
And we didn't even realize, you know, we think she's obviously very talented, but we never would have, you know, pictured her in a role like this.
And I think that Martha was really hungry to prove what she could do. And I think that we spent a lot of time maybe being underestimated by when people make assumptions about you, it does one of two things. It either makes you depressed or you say, fuck you, I'm going to prove you wrong. And Martha said, fuck you. And she was really, and you know, another, she committed fully. She never argued with me about script. She never argued with me about costumes. I sat her down and I said, listen, this is going to be weird as hell, but you've just got to trust me. You've got to believe that I have your best interest at heart, and I'm going to show the world, I'm going to give you a vehicle that you can use to show people that you can do this, because I believed in her. And she did it, and you know, and she took that opportunity, and she ran with it, and she really did right by it as an actress. So, you know, it's just one of those things where, and I enjoy writing strong female characters anyway. I love women don't get to play this kind of stuff that often. So I really love any chance that I can to say, hey, mm-hmm. you want to try something a little different? Because I kind of have this for you. Come play with me.
Yes.
And if, if you're open to doing that, then boom, we can have some fun.
She also, actually, during our interview with Martha, she had mentioned how everyone that you reached out to for particular roles ended up saying yes and joining. So when you were developing these characters, did you have people in mind? Or I know you said for her you did, like you mm-hmm. knew that was she was it. But for the
some
other
of them,
ones,
yes. Some of them, no.
Okay.
Linda, yes. Linda, we wrote that for her. I was like, oh, Jesus, we'll never be able to get Linda Gray. And then we got Linda Gray, and I was like, oh, my God, we got Linda. Kathleen Gaghi, who is just one of mm-hmm. my favorite people that we worked with, and I'm obsessed with her because she's such, not only is she the nicest woman, but she's just a phenomenal actress.
Yeah.
You know, she's Hungarian.
Brilliant.
She was born in Canada, but she is Hungarian by descent, and my wife is Hungarian. And so Kathleen did some major movies over in Hungary. So when her name came up, my wife was like, you've got to get her. She flipped out. And Debbie O'Connor, who does Your Number One Fan, she does a lot of the fan events. She was amazing and highly instrumental in helping us get Kathleen. She reached out to Kathleen and made some introductions and whatnot. And, Kirsten was another one. We really wanted her for that part. Wasn't sure if that was going to work out, but it did. And, you know, pretty much, yeah, everybody that we wanted, we were able to get. And I think that everything falls into place. You know, Gordon, I wrote it for him. I want Gordon in everything that mm-hmm. I ever do, just because over the years, from Divanity to this, he's become a good friend. You know, like, we have dinner mm-hmm. with him and we hang out with him, and I call him on the phone once a week to chat and, you know, make sure he's doing well. So, you know, over time you build these relationships with people and you hopefully build a positive reputation with people where people want to work with you, and they do know that you're not going to do anything to make them look bad. And that's why I always, the hardest part of getting any actor for a web series is, A, are they willing to work for the pretty crappy money? And B, are you going to make sure that they're not going to regret doing this later and feel like a fool? And that's the hardest part, is saying, I know you're asking a total stranger to trust you, to trust them, but just trust me. I it doesn't help me to make you look like a jerk. I don't want that for you.
Right.
I want to build a vehicle for you to be your very best with the resources that I have available, and that's what I've always tried to do as a producer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is kind of switching gears a little bit, but we were curious if you had a favorite scene for Winterthorne, and which one it was, and why did you favorite it?
A favorite scene.
See, you're throwing your curveball there, Michael.
I loved the dinner table scene. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed working with everybody that day. We all had a really fun day that day. We shot, that was a long day, but it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. I loved Kathleen Gaghi Day.
Mm-hmm,
that was
mm-hmm.
a really, really fun day. I wouldn't say that there's nothing mm-hmm. specific. For me, it's moments. It's the moments where you pull back and you're looking at your crew and they're happy, and you're looking at your cast and they're happy, and everybody's, you know, enjoying their time with each other, and it makes you feel the sense of pride. And, you know, we everybody worked so hard on the show, the cast and the crew. Everyone was really excited to be there, and that's my favorite moment. My favorite moment is when you see that smile on, you know, somebody's face, and they're happy to be working with you, and they're grateful to be a part of something special. And so it's not really about scenes. It's really about the behind-the-scenes moments that I enjoy the best.
Awesome. And, Michael, we also wanted to ask, too, was there a particular scene or scenes that proved you know, harder to shoot, meaning, you know, you didn't anticipate it until you actually started shooting it, or, you know, maybe the vision wasn't, you know, you were having issues since, you know, it is a very unique setting, and kind of how did you overcome that at the time?
The hardest thing that we had to shoot would probably be the marshmallow bathtub, logistically speaking. marshmallows don't hold up very well. So in the tub, we had a few inches of water in the base of the tub. We ended up using about 80 bags of marshmallows, and they had to be passed over because once we were in the tub, we couldn't get out. Like, they had to be put over me. And we also had a last-minute change of location. We weren't supposed to shoot it. We were supposed to shoot it somewhere else. We had to move it into my bathroom. So, okay, A, how do we make this bathroom look expensive? And B, how do we hide the goddamn toilets? So the way we had to really kind of engineer everything very, very specifically. And then once Martha and I were in that tub together, that was it. And as the marshmallows are decomposing, like, they were sticking to her dress, and the smell of melting marshmallows is not pleasant. By the time we finished shooting that scene, we were both crawling. I mean, we're fully clothed in a bathtub covered in wet, dying marshmallows. With candles, and, like, don't let the candles melt down.
You had the hands, too, Michael.
We were terrified that the candles would melt down so much that they would set the marshmallows on fire. That was a really big concern. So, you know, that was logistically, I think, pretty tricky. But, you know, filming in the woods was actually delightful. Doing, you know, Steve Silverman, who is one of our fabulous co-executive producers, and Brandon Goins,
yes,
who is our stunt coordinator. They were, one of our units was filming at another location, and Steve and Brandon and I went over to this other spot, and they were literally unwrapping the lollipops while I was putting them into the ground. So when the other unit was finished filming, they would come over to this set, and boom, we would go ahead and just film all of that. And so really it's about trying to be, you know, to plan everything far enough in advance to where you can knock it out and get it done in a timely manner. So, but yeah, I would say overall it was a very pleasant shoot. There was no major drama or anything, you know, little things here and there. We were filming with Linda Gray. Oh, my God. And outside on the street below, a street musician started playing his freaking guitar. And it was so loud. You know, it's really hard in general to get rid of the city noises. And we kind of cheat that in the show and say, well, they're in the city. You're going to hear, you know, cars and whatever driving by. And you can play that off a little bit. But this is like pure, like, electric guitar music. And thankfully, I was not in that scene because I started to get pissed because, you know, you got Linda Gray. You don't waste time when you got an actor like that on your set. Any actor, but you're dealing with Linda Gray, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I literally went down across the street and I went up to this musician and I said, okay, how much do you make in a day? And he goes, I don't know, like $50. And I go, great, I'll give you $80 to get your fucking guitar and get out of here because I've got Linda Gray upstairs. He's like, who's Linda Gray? I said, you should be ashamed of yourself for not knowing that.
Yeah, it should be illegal to even say that.
He goes, well, when can I play again? And I go, tomorrow. You have $80. Go spend it on drugs. Get out of here.
I didn't even. Michael, I didn't even know, just to give you an idea. Like, my mom, you know, obviously a huge Days fan, loves checking out web series. I didn't even know that she, like, watched Dallas or really watched any other shows. And I kid you not, one of the first things she said to me was, Liz, did you watch Winterthorn yet? Michael got Linda Gray. And I was like, yes, I know. Like, I mean, I'm telling you, that was, you know, it was exciting.
And she was
everyone
lovely.
Was like,
she was
yeah.
so, she's one of the nicest people. You know, you think about her career. I mean, she's gotten 2 Golden Globe nominations. She could not be nicer, friendlier. Everybody was just in love with her. She's a very sweet, sweet lady, incredibly talented, such a great actress. It was a very special day for all of us, me being a very big Dallas fan, and Martha being a very big Dallas fan. It was really just a wonderful time working with her. We all knew how lucky and grateful we were to have her.
Definitely. I know we're always like, oh, you know, we're shifting gears here, but Michael, you know, we always admit we love getting your thoughts on not just your projects, but on, you know, kind of, you know, soaps in general. Let's face it, you're insightful. You know, we can't help it. That's your fault. We know that you, obviously, you're sometimes a sub-co-host on the Radio Soapbox with Martha Madison. Mm-hmm. Just want to say very quickly, guys, if you haven't checked out the Radio Soapbox, you know, and you love soaps, and you want a really great interview, and you want a really great show where they cover a variety of topics, including, you know, everything happening in daytime, you got to get over to the Radio Soapbox. Go to Martha's page, and she tweets when she's having a show. It's phenomenal. But we love getting your insight into all things daytime. And, you know, I love the show. I listen to it all the time. One of my favorites was when you guys, you know, had Michael Fairman on. And I think that was because you guys were just discussing so many, you know, current topics and just everything daytime and writing. What are your current thoughts, you know, just curious, you know, what you're thinking. What are your current thoughts on daytime with all the changes that are taking place on quite a few of them? And what are you most looking forward to this fall?
That's a big question. I think that, you know, I think that already Days is, it's so good. And I think that Josh and Dina are really, you know, they really committed to making the show bring it back to its glory days and really doing right by the characters and writing authentic characters and, you know, really just kind of delving into the history of the show itself. You can't ignore the history of the show. You know, I think where the new Dallas kind of ran into a few problems is that they conveniently just decided to ignore a lot of history. And I think that was a very big mistake. And I think that you, if you want to piss off a viewer, ignore firmly established realities within this universe and just say, yeah, that didn't happen, or yeah, we're going to fudge that. If it's in the show, if it was on the show, it's canon. And you can't just, you know, you might be able to come up with a, you might be able to deconstruct it in a different way, but you can't ignore it. As far as you're asking me what, like, daytime in general,
that's basically, you just answered that question. And we were just wondering, like, is there anything in particular, you know, we know you watch a few of them that, you know, you're kind of looking forward to, you know, in terms of even storyline or, you know, new arrivals, anything like that?
I'm looking forward to Martha. I'm dying to see what she does back on Days. I'm looking forward to Jean-Paul Lavoisier, who I loved working with. I'm looking forward to seeing him on Days. You know, I guess my big wish for the daytime world is I wish, and it's not their fault per se, because they're under a lot of pressure and there's a lot of other behind-the-scenes stuff that affect it. I wish that daytime was more open to bringing on new talent, both as actors
and writers and
producers.
People
always tweet at me, why don't you go write for this show, or why don't you do this for this show? And my response is always the same, which is, a daytime soap would never, ever hire me in a million years, because I'm an outsider. No. This isn't me, like, beating myself up or anything. When was the last time you heard of an unknown writer or a new writer or somebody that wasn't already in the daytime machine getting hired? I mean,
it's a revolving door.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of show hopping that goes on, and to me, I understand the concept of wanting to work with people that are proven and people that, you know, you can trust. I mean, it is a machine, and they don't have a lot of time for learning curve, I think, like they did back when there were, you know, 15 shows on the air and all of the stuff like that. It's sad to me that there's no next generation being cultivated. It's sad to me that, you know, the soaps used to be a great place where a lot of new actors mm-hmm. were discovered, a new talent was discovered. Maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, people on Twitter don't crucify me to a wall. I don't see a lot of that, and I feel that when people maybe do get hired, it might not always be for the reasons one would think. And I wish that things were more secure in the daytime world right now, where there was a willingness and an openness to say, let's give this person a shot. I would really like to, not even for me necessarily, but for you know, many other writers out there who I'm sure would make fantastic daytime writers. It's not a slam on anybody that's a writer. That's not me saying that I could do it better, people on Twitter or anything like that. I'm not implying any of that. I do think, though, that the daytime world, there is a very highly fortified wall around it, and
yeah.
it is very hard to break into that, even for somebody. Christ, I've got, you know, Divanity got, an Emmy nomination. Andrea Evans got an Emmy nomination. I created that character, wrote every line of dialogue, did Dunn Winterthorne, all this stuff like that. I've worked with all of these daytime people. My name would never be mentioned inside of a room at any of the shows. And I've accepted that because it's just not something that they want to do. And that's just something that you...
Yeah,
it sucks, but it's, you know, that's why I'm in online land, because I can do my thing and I can be creative and I have that freedom, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
yeah.
my wish
well,
for
Michael,
daytime is too.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, though, just very quickly, like, because, you know, I know you're saying, like, don't crucify me. You're not saying anything, you know, no one should crucify you for anything that you're saying, because you're not saying anything that fans haven't, already noticed. And I like that, you know, you pointed out. I mean, the running joke on Twitter is whenever you hear about a writing team getting fired, you automatically see people saying, like, well, you know, this one, you know, just let their head writer go. Like, you know what I mean? It's kind of like, it's not trying to be funny, but it is kind of like a revolving door. And that's
yeah.
what I mean about, like, I love when you and Martha, obviously I love her show, and I love when her and Lily discuss things, and I really love tuning in, because, you know, you even asked when you were, you know, co-hosting with Martha, you were all discussing this, and you asked Michael Fairman, like, well, why don't we ever see, like, any new names? And he said, he was like, you know, they used to have an apprenticeship program where
mm-hmm.
they would train, you know, emerging young writers, but they can't do that anymore. So
they don't do it anymore.
You know,
and you have to be... Whenever anybody asks me for my opinion on a show, the first thing that always comes to my mind is, anybody on earth always thinks that they can do it better. Everybody always has their version of what would work best. And you have to be fair to the writers, because, you know, nobody knows the behind the scenes. Nobody knows the true behind the scenes of Winterthorne or Divanity. Nobody knows the true behind the scenes of Days or GH or Linar or whatever. There's a lot
mm-hmm.
of people that get involved before that episode that everyone's bitching about on
yeah.
Twitter. There's a lot of
mm-hmm.
shit that went down between, you know, before the page, during the page, during the filming, and then what you see when it airs. So it's hard to critique something when you don't have all of the information. You know whether you watch something and you enjoy it or not. But God love them, you know, they're very hardworking people, and they're under an incredible amount of pressure, and I can't
mm-hmm.
imagine what it would be like to go to work from one day to the next every day wondering if I'm going to get shit canned today because
mm-hmm.
of a bad tweet, or because somebody's in a bad mood, or I forgot
yeah.
to buy the donuts on the way to work, or whatever, like...
Michael, you and the scenarios that you paint, I'm like dying
I know.
Over here.
Well, I mean, but, you
I'm
know,
like,
there's,
yeah,
there's
you know,
a lot
people
of,
do
there's
bring
a lot
donuts
of pressure.
To work.
It's,
yeah, and
it's,
Michael,
it's
Michael,
hard
not
to be creative when you're under that kind of pressure, is what I'm saying.
Oh,
and it's
sure.
hard when you're a writer and you're
yeah.
told what to write by somebody in particular. If that
mm-hmm.
one person in particular who's telling you what to write is telling you to write something that might not be going within the grain of what you believe, that's a challenge. That's a very difficult thing. It makes you just kind of say, all right, this is what they want. I guess I'll give it to them. So really, you're only as good as the people in charge at the end of the day.
Well, Michael, we have one more question for you. So that's why I was like, Michael,
yeah.
Wait, we have 90 seconds. It's fine because it's a question that we look forward to concluding with, and obviously we're excited to ask it. We wanted to know, and just everyone that, you know, if people are listening live, just know that it might cut off, but you'll be able to definitely, finish this interview once it, is available. And it usually takes about 15 minutes after the live show. But what we wanted to end with, Michael, is what does the future have in store for Winterthorne? You kind of touched on this a little, and it kind of made our night. We were kind of nervous that, we don't want it to end, that this might be literally like just a four-part series and that's it. Do you have plans to make, a season two or maybe start something else and revisit it? What are you thinking right now? What could you tell us?
Right now, the plan is Winterthorne is fully released as of today. A lot of people are going to be binge watching, and I do want to take a minute before I fully answer the question. Each and every one of the soap fans and everybody, the soap press, the bloggers, the blog talkers, everybody, for all of the love and all of the support, everybody has been beyond amazing and just more than I could have ever hoped for, more than any of us could have ever hoped for, have been backing this project and just really incredible. So please allow me to take a minute to just express my gratitude for all of that. I definitely would love to do more Winterthorne. As I said, a lot of it, more Winterthorne isn't really the issue. It's what kind of Winterthorne you're going to get is the issue. So meaning where the storyline goes and what I choose to focus on is really going to depend a lot on schedules and if we're able to raise X amount of dollars, what we're able to do, if there is further demand for it, aside from the people that just watched it today and they really like it. We will be putting it out on DVD to honor our Indiegogo campaign. I would love to try the plan right now is I think we're going to probably edit the four episodes together into a movie and try to do something internationally with it. I would love to be able to do that to kind of expand the audience. But yes, I have some really great plans for season two. If we do season two, and this is the first time I'm talking about this, so I guess you're getting the exclusive. We would meet Daphne in season two. We'd meet Colin's fiance in season two. We would meet a very mysterious person from Victor's life and his past. We would get to meet two of the aunts, maybe Corinne, maybe not, I don't know. And then we'd bring in some more characters, and I definitely want to do something in the desert, and I would love to do something by the ocean. So just to kind of see how the other portions of the family live and whatnot. So I would love to do more Winterthorne, but people have got to understand when they say there's only four episodes, it's so expensive, and we're able to really stretch the dollar and milk the dollar, but even then, we have very severe limitations of what we're able to do. If somebody wants to write me a check, then shit, let's do it. But, Indiegogo, our Indiegogo campaign was massively successful. That was just a fraction of the money that was spent on Winterthorne. The rest of that money came from myself and my wife and Steve Silverman and his husband, Jim. So there were a lot of other factors that went into the financing of the show. So that's something that I've got creative ideas for days, but you got to be able to make sure that the check's clear. And that's kind of one of those sticky issues. And once again, Martha's availability is something that we have to really explore. And I know that she really wants to, and I know that she's going to do her best. So that's all, we need to get Winterthorne season one out there to as many people as possible and really get that demand up, and we'll be able to do it.
Well, any way that we can help, Michael, obviously I hope you know this by now, we're always on board, and we want to thank you for, even working with a limited budget, you've never sacrificed quality. You've brought a lot of soap fans something that, we didn't really, you know, think we would see. You've brought a lot of great themes back to the soap community, and you've made something really amazing. So, well, no,
thank
I mean,
you.
It's the truth. And you know, let us know how we can help with the campaign and everything.
Soap fans are the greatest people on earth, and they're so loyal and respectful and appreciative. Until they're not, but for the most part,
I was going to say, they're like, one thing or the other. They're either all about it or they're like, what the hell?
We see what's happening on Twitter. It's
I choose to keep it positive. I love it when people enjoy the show. If people don't enjoy the show, that's fine too. Just don't be a mean jerk about it. Just it privately. If I could have my druthers or whatever, that's a little delusional, but. You know, soap fans are amazing, and they deserve great content, and they deserve to be listened to and to be taken seriously. And I think that respect is a two-way street, and I always try to be very respectful of the soap fans. So that's, you know, we do our best, right?
Very good.
No, you do an amazing job. And, Michael, we want to thank you because, you know, we know, obviously, you know, you're very busy, and we really appreciate, you know, you coming on and you know, again,
I love you, girl.
It's two-way street.
You
always have supported us. Yeah.
You ask the best questions. I love your questions. So I'm always glad to stop by and see how you two crazy girls are doing. I'm glad that Britt there survived Cancun.
Barely. I was like, I don't know about you, but I was like stalking her Facebook, and I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm like, I think she's going to come back. Stalker. Yes. So thank you so much, Michael. It really means
a
lot.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me. Now go watch episode 4. Go have fun.
I was just going to say, everyone have a great night. You know, Michael, we will be promoting this all week, so definitely encourage people to check out the interview. And I'm going to go watch part 4 right now.
Woohoo! All right, girls, love you. Thank you so much.
Love you. Thank you. Give our love to Barbie.
I will. Yes. Bye.
All right, bye.
Bye. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Have a great night.